I want to take up now in volume 16, and we're in the middle of a message that started on March the 22nd, 1924. So I'm not going to go back to summarise, because the people who have listened to the previous thing can continue on the next. So Louisa said, "My Jesus disappeared, and I remained more embittered, thinking about the ugly, vertiginous race of creatures. That is the headlong race into chaos and nothingness." Okay. And about the turmoil which nature will cause against them. Now, we're already living at that stage where nature is rebelling against the human race. Then, as I returned to prayer, my Jesus came back in a pitiful state. He seemed restless. He was moaning and he was grieving. He laid himself within me and would turn now to the right and then to the left. I asked him, "Jesus, my love, what's wrong? Please, you suffer too much. Let us share the pains. Do not want to be alone. So don't you see how much you suffer and that you can take no more?" So while I was saying this, I found myself outside of myself in the arms of a priest. So she's in her out-of-the-body experience, okay? However, while the person seemed to be a priest, it seemed to me that his voice was that of Jesus. So I want to give you Hebrews 4, 14 to 16. Jesus is our great high priest. And he said to me, "We will cover an extremely long way. Be attentive to what you see." And while we were walking without touching the ground, now that's typical of out of the body. First, I was carrying him in my arms, but since a dog was following him, that's Satan tagging along, but he can't actually stop the work. Many people don't realise that a dog is a symbol of Satan. They know that the pig is a symbol of Satan, but they don't actually know that a dog is and that he can come and manifest a presence through a dog. You will recognise it if it happens to you. But since a dog was following me, as if it wanted to bite me, I was afraid. Now, notice that the satanic presence wants to attack the human. He can't touch the divine. He can't touch the divine will. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. So he tries to attack the human. And he also attacked Jesus in the wilderness as well, in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. Okay. But that was because he was dealing with Jesus in his humanity. So to free me from fear, we changed position and he carried me. You remember the footsteps? Yeah, that the Lord carries us when we're in trouble. I said to him, "Why did you not do it before? You caused me to be scared." Now notice she's blaming him. But I didn't say anything because I thought it was necessary that I carry you. Now I am content because as I'm carried in your arms, it will not be able to do anything to me anymore. Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd. There is nothing I shall want." And I kept saying, "Jesus is carrying me in his arms." And he would repeat, that should be a capital H. He would repeat, "I'm saying Jesus is in my arms." She said, "Jesus is in my arms." He said, "Jesus is in my arms." So it didn't matter whether she carried him or he carried her. Why? Because they are one. Okay. But that dog followed our whole journey. Now, that dog has been following the whole history of the human race and trying to interrupt and destroy what God is doing. Only it kept one of my feet in its mouth, but without biting it. In other words, he tries to keep a grip on a situation. It's very interesting. When you consider the height that Louisa has reached and that Satan can still get a grip on her foot, even in this out-of-the-body experience, because, I mean, he's a spirit. He hasn't got a body. But without biting it, because she was in Jesus' arms. The journey was long, and I often asked, "How much more do we have left?" And he said, 100 more miles. And then I asked again, he said 30 more and so on until we arrived in the city. Now, it seems to me from the context that the city is Rome. Okay. And now, who can say what can be seen along the way? At some points, towns were in a heap of stones. Somewhere else, places which were flooded and towns buried underwater. Well, you don't need to have an apparition anymore for that. You can get it on the television any day you like. Okay. And so rivers, and at some points, there were chasms of fire opened up. Now, to me, a chasm of fire would be like Yellowstone Park in the United States blowing. Okay. It seemed to me that all the elements were agreeing among themselves to harm the human generation. So that's nature at war with man, forming the graves in which to bury them. Even more, what could be seen along the way and was most frightening and horrifying were the evils of people themselves. Okay, now watch this. Everything was darkness that came from them, but thick darkness. Now, if you remember back to the Exodus, the ninth plague was thick darkness. Now, you can have a darkness that is the absence of light, and you can have a thick darkness. And in the book of Exodus, it said that the darkness was so thick you could feel it. Now, that's not the absence of light, it's the presence of evil. Is that okay? So this thick darkness is talking about the presence of evil, accompanied by a rotten and poisonous closeness, which, of course, is Satan himself. The darkness was such that many times one could not even discern what the place was. Everything seemed pretense and duplicity. Now, the 20th century was the century of deception. And it started out with the whole communist revolution, deceiving everybody. Okay. And you know that deception is the first horseman of the apocalypse in Revelation 6:2. Deception. Now, if you're afraid of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, relax, because we've had the four horsemen of the apocalypse for the whole of the 20th century. And if you were born in the 20th century, you've had it for the whole of your life. So, you know, when you read dramatic descriptions like that, you can think this must be some horrifying new thing. You've experienced it, because it's a deception, war, plague, famine and death. And they're the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So everything was pretense and duplicity. And if there was any good at all, it was only superficial and apparent. In other words, people are still going to church, but there's no real faith there. Okay. But inside, there were smouldering the ugliest vices. So they're going to church, but they're not actually living as Christians. So if they're living in sin, you've got the smouldering ugliest vices and plotting the most insidious snares, which displease the Lord more than if they were openly doing evil. Now, if you go to 2 Thessalonians 2:4, the people are living the lie. That means they're living Satan's way and clothed in Christianity, if I can put it that way. But also in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, Paul says that iniquity works away in a hidden way before it comes out into the open. Okay. So it displeased the Lord more than if they were doing it out in the open. And this was in all classes of people. Now, all classes of people means you're talking about priests, religious and laity. There's nobody left out. Like a woodworm that gnaws the whole root of good. Now, we're living at the stage where that a terrible thing has gone right into the Vatican. And it's publicly known. I'm not saying anything that isn't publicly known. In other places, one could see revolutions, murdering of people by ambush. But who can say all that could be seen? So there's your Amos 3:7, that the Lord tells the prophets ahead of time what's going to happen. So, tired of seeing so many evils, I often repeated, but when are we going to finish this long journey? And he who was carrying me, all pensive, answered, "A little more, you've not seen everything yet." And I don't think you and I have seen everything yet either. So in the next paragraph then, we're told what we are to do. Finally, after long struggling, I found myself inside of myself in my bed. And my sweet Jesus, who continued to moan because he was suffering very much, stretching out his arms to me, told me, "My daughter, give me a little rest, for I can take no more." And leaning his head upon my breast, he seemed to want to sleep. But his sleep was not a peaceful one. And I, not knowing what to do, remembered. Now, when we finish volume 16 and go into volume 17, we're going to be told how desperately important for us it is to remember everything that Jesus has done for us and to remember what we are to do for others. Remembering is desperately important. In the very first chapter of Luke's Gospel, we're told that, first of all, the Lord remembered that it was time for the Messiah to come. So the angel Gabriel went to Zechariah and informed him that John the Baptist was to be born. And with the miracle of John the Baptist's birth and the miracle that happened to his parents, the people remembered it was time. So first of all, you have the Lord remembering, then you have the people remembering. Okay, and then the whole mystery could happen. So not knowing what to do, I remembered his most holy will, in which there was full rest, and said to him, "My love, I lay my intelligence in your will." This is very important. "In order to find your uncreated intelligence, so that by laying mine within yours, I may shade all created intelligences in such a way that you may feel your shadow placed before all created minds, and you may find rest for the sanctity of your intelligence." It's a wonderful little act there, given to you in completely there. "I lay my word," this is the second one, "in your fiat, in order to place the shadow of that omnipotent fiat before all the human voices, so that your breath and your mouth may be able to find rest. Number three, I lay my works in yours, to place the shadow of the sanctity of your works before the works of all creatures, so as to give you rest for your hands. I lay my little love in your will, to place you in the shade of your immense love, which I place before the hearts of all, to give rest to your weary heart. As I kept saying this, Jesus calmed himself and fell into a sweet sleep. Then after some time he woke up, but he was calm, and pressing me to himself, he said, 'My daughter, I was able to rest because you surrounded me with the shadows of my works.'" There's the secret. "And the shadows of my fiat and of my love. This is the rest that I spoke after I created all things." Remember at the end of Genesis chapter 1, the Lord rested. "And since man was the last to be created, I wanted to rest in him." Okay. Now, one of the wonderful things about John's gospel that people don't see at all, and it has to be pointed out to them, is that you're told in the book of Genesis that you have the whole description of creation in chapter 1, and then God rests at the end of this creative process. In the Gospel of John, you're told who Jesus is, that he's divine, and he goes through all the work of redemption, and he rests in the tomb on the great Sabbath. And that's the rest after creation, after redemption. And it's totally parallel to the rest after creation. Okay. And the amazing thing is that when Jesus lay in the tomb on that Saturday, it was the most sacred Sabbath they could have, because the Passover fell on that particular day. So as the Jewish people themselves would say, never a dog would bark. So I wanted to rest in man, that is, by virtue of my will acting in him, which formed my shadow in him, I was to find my rest and the fulfillment of my works. But this was denied to me because he didn't want to do my will. And until I find someone who wants to live in my will, which overshadows my image in the soul, not finding my shadow, I cannot rest, because I cannot complete my works, and give the last divine brush stroke to all creation. Now, the brush stroke is Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art. But with strong purges, such that many will lose their lives, is the way he'll have to do it. In other words, he'll have to enforce it. And you have patience and always follow my will. Now, those strong purges are the three great cleansings of the human race that's described in the book of Revelation. Okay. So April the 8th, 1924. The crushing weight of the offences of creatures. Now, that is described very well in the 3 hours of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane that Louisa goes into such great detail with. So, in the divine will, sleep also is an embankment for divine justice. The privations of my sweet Jesus continue, and I spend my days in a living purgatory. I feel I'm dying. Now, this will all be explained as we go into volume 17. I feel I'm dying and I do not die. I call him, I rave, but in vain. I feel a tragic scene take place in my interior, such that if it could be seen externally, even the stones would be moved to pity and would melt into tears. But alas, no one is moved to pity for me, not even that very Jesus who used to say he loved me so much. It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? But of course, Jesus has already explained to her earlier than volume 16, is that if she hadn't seen him so frequently, she wouldn't have this crushing need for him. And the reason why we don't feel a crushing need for him is that we've not seen him and experienced him the way she has. But Louisa said, as I was at the peak of my pains, my beloved Jesus, my life, my all, moved in my interior, and forming a cradle with his arms, rocking me, said, rockabye, my daughter, sleep in the arms of your Jesus. Rockabye, my little one. Rockabye, baby. Okay. And in seeing that after falling asleep, I would wake up again, he repeated, rockabye, my daughter. So unable to resist, unwilling and crying, I fell into a deep sleep. In other words, she never wants to sleep when he's around. She wants to be completely awake. Now, why is he putting her to sleep? Is to give her the healing that she actually needs. After hours and hours of sleep without being able to wake up, my sweet Jesus, holding me tightly, leaned on the place of my heart, letting me feel an enormous weight that crushed me. Now, that sleep is enabling her to take what he's offering now. But in spite of this, I couldn't wake up. Oh, how many things I would have wanted to tell him, but my sleep prevented me. Now, he doesn't want the long story, you see. He just wants to get on with the job. Then after much struggling between vigil and sleep, I saw that my good Jesus was suffering very much, so much as to be as though suffocated amid pains. And I said to him, my love, you suffer very much, to the point of suffocating, but then you want me to sleep? Why don't you let me suffer together with you? She's always wanted that. And if you want me to sleep, why don't you sleep together with me? In other words, let's rest together, let's work together. And Jesus, all afflicted, told me, my daughter, the offences they give me are so many. Now, this is 1924, in the build-up to the Second World War. And communism and Marxism and Freemasonry and the occult are really on the rampage, as our Blessed Lady warned in 1917, do you remember? The offences they give me are so many that I feel I'm being drowned with pains. Now, don't forget, as he is speaking, that the whole Orthodox Church in Russia and in the countries around are being persecuted to death. Nobody knows the millions that died in Russia in the 20th century. Nobody counted them. All we know is that they died in millions. And if I wanted to share them with you, he said, you would not be able to endure and remain alive. It's too much for a human being. Don't you feel the weight that they give me to the point of crushing me, which is such that since I am within you, it's inevitable for me to share it with you. So if Jesus is living within her and he feels crushed, of course she's going to feel it. And if I wanted to sleep together with you, my justice would pour out freely against man and the world would roll. I like that expression, don't you? In other words, it would really be finished. And as he was saying this, Jesus closed his eyes and it seemed that the world was rolling and that all created things were going out of order. Notice going out of order. The water, the fire, the earth, the mountains, said they were all jumbling together and becoming homicidal and noxious for man. So there's the human race creation gone into rebellion against the human race. Who can say the great troubles that were happening? So Jesus is trying to make Louisa aware of what he's suffering, and that if he didn't ask her to participate with him in intercession and suffering, that this, in fact, would be going on. In other words, you and I wouldn't have had a chance to live at all. The earth would have been finished. Who can say the great troubles that were happening? Taken by fright, I cried out, Jesus, open my eyes, do not sleep. Don't you see that all things are jumbling and putting themselves in disorder? And he said, have you seen my daughter? I cannot sleep. I just closed my eyes. And if you knew how many evils occurred just in Jesus closing his eyes. As he's trying to explain to her that there was no way he could do it. For you, it is necessary to sleep that I may not see you succumb completely. So he was trying to prepare her for what he was going to share. However, know that I placed you in the center of my will so that your sleep also will be an embankment for my justice, which justly wants to pour out against man. Now, a very important point is being made there. Is that when we lie down to rest, that we should ask the Lord to rest in us, in the divine will, and let us rest in him. I think that's a terribly important aspect of the whole thing. And he says here that when we rest in him, that there is an embankment of the divine justice. So if you're doing it in the divine will, it still is operating to sort of keep things calm and in order. So April the 11th, 1924, we've got scenes of chastisement. So Louisa said, I feel dazed and sleepy. My powers, that's intellect, memory and will, no longer understand anything. And if I understand anything at all, it's just some moment of break, of vigil, but I feel a shadow around me, which overshadowing me completely, deep into the most inmost fibres, makes me long and yearn for the holy will of God. Now, overshadowing me completely, that's the overshadowing of the Spirit. That's the overshadowing of the Holy Spirit. Remember that in the Incarnation, our Blessed Mother was overshadowed by the Holy Spirit. Now, troubled as I was by the chastisements, which Jesus had talked to me about, and by the sight of the turmoil of created things, I also heard that some people of the great evils that occurred during the last days in several parts of the world, up to the destruction of entire regions. Now, this is 1924. I just don't know if that happened in 1924. I don't know if it happened since. I just don't know. So he's talking about the destruction of entire regions. And that would be something that would impact on every nation on earth. So I have a feeling that it didn't happen, did it?
It could be the Great Depression of 1921 in America.
No, destruction of entire regions.
It's an entire region.
Entire region. Destruction, to me, means that the place is wiped out.
Hiroshima? No,
I don't think so. Because they were bombs dropped on particular cities. But entire regions. I mean, Europe would be a region. Asia would be a region. You know what I mean? Japan would be a region. They haven't been, nothing has been totally wiped out. So if not, that's still in the future. But as I was hearing this, my Jesus moving in my interior told me, my daughter, this is nothing yet. Holy heavens. We will go further in purifying the face of the earth. I am so disgusted in looking at it that I cannot bear the sight of it. Imagine God says that about his own creation. And so Louisa said, I remained oppressed more than ever, and the horrible picture of the turmoil of nature, which I had seen in the past days, became alive before my mind. And then, going back to prayer according to my usual way, I said to my beloved Jesus, since you are determined to lay hand to chastisement and I can no longer do anything, either suffer or have people spared the evils that they deserve, you could free me from this state of victim. She never wants to stay one instant if she isn't doing her job, or suspend me for some time. At least I would spare others the bother. Now, the others are the priests, of course. And Jesus said, my daughter, I do not want to displease you. If you want me to suspend you, I will do it. This is how dangerous the human will is. Because if you ask God to do something, he'll do it. But you could be asking him for the most awful thing for yourself. You know, we're very much like a small child in a kitchen who wants to play with that kitchen knife. But the mother loves the child too much and takes the knife out of the hand and says, no, no, have this instead. Because that will cause destruction. This won't. And so look how dangerous it is. And so Jesus makes her take responsibility. She's been at this point many times. And he makes her take responsibility that she wants to give her will to him, that she wants to take care of others, and that she shouldn't be tempted to give up so easily, you know. And so Louisa said, fearing that I might do my will, you see, she's been alerted to it, immediately added, no, no, my love, you should not say to me, if you want, but rather you should say, I am the one who wants to suspend you from this day. In other words, I want this, but you're the one that's going to take responsibility for it. You see, it should not come from my will, but from yours. And then I would accept. So not to make me content, but to let your will be done in me. And Jesus said, I do not want to displease you. In other words, you can't get around me with these words. This is what you said. And you're trying to make me take responsibility for what you want. Sorry, we're not playing either. Either you take responsibility for your decision or you don't. It's very interesting. And we do that with the Lord. We give him all kinds of reasons. I want you to heal my Aunt Mary. You know, she's very good and she always goes to Mass and she looks after other people. And we give him 102 reasons why he should look after my Aunt Mary. He died for her. I didn't. I don't give him any reasons. But that's us twisting his arm. And we think we can twist his arm like we can twist the arms of human beings. You can't. The most perfect thing for the Aunt Mary is his will. The absolute perfect thing. So I love these little tussles between them because he's making her take responsibility. You see, when Adam was asked, why did you eat the apple? He said, "That's the woman you gave me." And he said to the woman, why did you do it? She said, well, it was the serpent. And when he said to the serpent, why did you do it? She said, the serpent just shrugged his shoulders. They were dead easy to play with. And as long as we're willing to pass on the responsibility to others, we are not actually taking the responsibility of the decisions we need to take in order to grow in holiness. I've said it to you a number of times, I will never be a pilot flying an airplane unless A, I decide to do it. And if I decide to do it, I'll put myself through the hassle of learning how to be a pilot and all that goes with it. But it's a decision all along the way. It's even a decision the day I do my exam. And it's a big decision the day I get into an airplane and have 50 people and their lives on my watch. You know what I mean? So it's decisions all the way, all the way, all the way. You know that with marriage as well. It was dead easy to sign your name the first day. 20 years later, it might be harder to sign your name.
40 gets harder.
Because you're right. Because it's a decision every single day. And 40 years later, the two of you are two completely different people than you were 40 years ago. You know what I mean? So it's a decision every single day. And if we don't take the decision, the marriage isn't there, is it? You know? So Jesus said, I don't want to displease you. I want to make you content. In other words, I'll do your will. If you want me to suspend you, I will do it. But it's your decision, you see. However, know that my justice wants to follow its course, and you and I must surrender in part. You're saying all the time you want to be in the divine will, you want to do the divine will. And as I said on that little talk that I gave on Mary's Hill, you think you've surrendered to God until the Lord asks you to do something you don't want to do. That's when you find out. So Jesus is insisting that if she really is in the divine will, now we're going to see her really transformed as she goes on in the higher volumes, where she's, if you're really surrendered to God's will, it is God's will that operates, and I don't tell him what he should do with me. That's a hard one for us, isn't it? That's what she's telling him. If you do this, why don't you suspend me? We like telling God his job. I think everybody can pope except the man who has the job. Mm-hmm. Everyone can tell footballers on the field what to do. You're sitting on a sofa looking at it. You're not down there on the field. So, however, Jesus said, you and I, they are one because she's in union with God. We must surrender in part. There are certain rites of justice which one cannot do without. All the attributes of God are equal. And justice has the right to manifest itself just as mercy and love and wisdom and all the others have the right to manifest. So justice has certain rights. But since I have placed you in the centre of my will in this state of victim, even if you should now sleep or suffer or pray, it is always an embankment for my justice. He's already told her that. But you know, how many times does the Lord have to tell us something before we register it? And this embankment of justice will prevent the course of an almost total destruction of things. Now, that is about as big as it can get. If I was Louisa, I'd be shaken in my shoes. In fact, this is not only about the chastisements, it's about destruction. So I want to give you two references, which we will deal with only in the scripture class because it's the book of Revelation. Revelation 6, 16 to 17 and Revelation 11, 18. Now, if you only want to look up one of them, look up Revelation 11, 18. It says this, I will destroy the destroyers of the earth. Okay. Because the destroyers of the earth are the ones who are absolutely pitting themselves against God's will. So in the next long paragraph, he tells her the danger of refusing divine will. However, know that I will not force you. I have never liked force. So much so that when I came upon the earth and wanted to go and be born in Bethlehem, I went, yes, knocking at door after door to have a place in which to be born. But I did not force anybody. Had I wanted to, with my power, I could have used force in order to obtain a place less uncomfortable in order to be born. But I didn't want to do it. I contented myself with only knocking and asking. Now, that's our problem with God. To use a very Irish expression, he's a gentleman. He won't force himself. And we can refuse an awful lot easier than we think. I contented myself with only knocking and asking for shelter, but without insisting. I moved on to knock on other doors. And since no one wanted to receive me, I contented myself with going to be born in a grotto, in which animals gave me free entrance, which human beings didn't do, and did the first adorations of their creator. Now, the next bit is the hair curling bit. All actions have consequences, good and bad. However, this refusal cost the people of Bethlehem very much because they never again received the good that my souls would trade on their lands. Isn't that incredible? Yeah. Now, he travelled all over Israel and he preached the gospel in season and out of season all over the place. He never went back to Bethlehem. Isn't that scary? They never had the good of seeing me in their midst again. In other words, actions have consequences. I like spontaneous things, he said, not forced ones. I like for the soul to make what I want her own. And as though it were hers and not mine. He keeps on saying that he wants us to receive the divine will as ours and to act as the owners. And to give me what I want freely with love for me. So the only motivation he wants on our part is that we surrender in love. He's not interested in anything else. Force is for slaves, for servants, and for those who don't love. This is why, just as with those people of Bethlehem, I move on from those souls who are not ready to let me enter into them, and they're not ready to give me full freedom to do what I want in them. Note that when you're trying to tell people about divine will, if they show that they're not interested, move on. The Lord will show you who to go to. On hearing this, Louisa said, "My love, Jesus, no, I do not want to be forced, but freely I want to remain in this state." Well, that's taken her quite a bit now to get to that point, isn't it? Now, but we've been round this roundabout a number of times. Even at the cost of mortal pains, she said, "And you never leave me and give me the grace to always do your will." Now, that's quite a bit of drama over that one thing, isn't it? Okay. So the next one is April the 23rd, 1924. The state of profound sleep of Louisa continues. Together with Jesus, she suffers the crushing weight of the world. Now, this time she has agreed to actually go into the divine will and let the divine will do what it wants. I spend my days in bitterness and in the privation of my sweet Jesus, with the addition of a profound sleep, such that I myself do not know where I am or what I'm doing. I feel the shadow of my Jesus around me, which puts me as though into an iron shirt that renders me immobile. I think that's rather interesting. In other words, she said she really wanted it, and this time he takes a firm grip to make sure that she doesn't want to slip out again. What a sorrowful change. This iron shirt that makes me immobile, it takes life away from me and dazes me, and I no longer understand anything. What a sorrowful change in my interior. Now, she says that because we human beings don't like not being in control. We find it extremely difficult that we're not in control. I, who did not know what sleep was, and even if a light sleep would surprise me, even while sleeping, I would not lose the attitude of my interior. In other words, she'd keep the conscious communion with God. I was aware of the fibre of my heart and of my thoughts in order to give them back to Jesus, who so much loved me, to accompany him in all the hours and pains of his passion. So that living contact was continuous, what I call 24/7, 365, okay? Or I would wander within the immensity of his will and give back to him everything and those acts which he wanted from all creatures. Now, I think there's a lovely idea there. And I call it horizontal prayer. Because when you get into the divine will, really into it, you don't have to have the sort of liturgical attitudes that you have. You can do it very well in a horizontal position. In fact, I find sometimes it works best that way, because your whole being relaxes, and you darken the room as much as possible just so that you just have enough light to see, because light is actually quite a distraction when you go into your interior, and sink right down into the depths of your interior in the divine will, and you and himself take it off from there and see where it goes. It's the most wonderful way to sleep. I try to do that every night. It doesn't guarantee you 8 hours sleep, but it's a lovely way to get there. But during the day, if you have an hour that you could rest, it's actually a very good way to do it. Whereas bolt upright, sort of, you'll have to make all these acts and I've got to do all this and all that and all the other. It's me in control, isn't it? The other way is surrendering absolutely into the divine will and letting the divine will have the control. We find that difficult. When you learn how to do it, it's beautiful. It's actually beautiful. So instead of talking about surrender, you just actually do it. So this is in her sleepy point. I would wander within the immensity of his will and give back to him all those acts and so on. And now she said, everything is over. My Jesus, what bitter pains, what a sorrowful sea you want my poor soul to navigate. Please give me strength and do not leave me, do not abandon me. Remember that you yourself said that I am little, or rather the littlest of all, just newly born. And if you leave me, if you do not help me, if you no longer give me the strength, the newborn will certainly die. Okay. So, while I was in this state, Louisa said, I thought to myself, who knows whether it is the devil who forms this shadow over me and puts me in this state of immobility. Now, it's good for her to keep the discernment going, because what's happening to her is very dramatic. With us, we don't have this kind of drama. But as I was thinking this, I felt crushed more than ever under this enormous weight. And my beloved Jesus moving in my interior, he's in the interior. That's Luke 17:21. The kingdom of God is within you. Placed the edge of a wheel upon me, which he was carrying, and all afflicted, he said to me, my daughter, have patience. This is the weight of the world that crushes us. Now, the weight of the world is the weight of sin. And if you go into the second hour of Gethsemane in the hours of the Passion, Louisa deals with that, when the weight of the sins of the world crushed Jesus and made him sweat blood. Okay. So here Louisa is participating in this. Yet one single edge leaning on you serves me so as not to end it all with the world. So in other words, even a small participation on your part makes a huge difference. Okay. So to end it with all the world, I want to give you Revelation 14, verses 7 to 11. Revelation 16:19 and Revelation 17:4. Jesus said, if you only knew how many deceits, how many frauds, how many evils they commit, how many hidden machinations of ruin they are plotting. Now, these hidden machinations of ruin are the communists, the Illuminati, the occult, the Freemasonry, the One World stuff and all the rest of it. All that hidden iniquity that Paul speaks about in 2 Thessalonians. All the machinations of ruin they're plotting to be ruined more among themselves, which increase even more the weight on my shoulders to the point of making the scale of divine justice overflow. So this is why there will be great evils throughout the whole earth. In other words, ferocious cleansing has got to take place. And besides, why do you fear when it might be the enemy that puts you in this state? When it is the enemy, now he gives her the discernment, when it is the enemy that makes you suffer, he casts desperation, impatience and disturbance into you. You don't need the S. So by their fruits, you will know them. If the enemy produces this, you know it's him. If dealing with the Lord always gives you a deep, deep peace. And if you've got that deep peace within your being, no matter what storms are on the outside, you're okay. Once that peace is there. The peace that passes all understanding. So, on the other hand, Jesus said, when it is I infuse love, patience, peace, light and truth. Now there's your discernment. You'll always know who's at work. Do you perhaps feel impatient and desperate, and do you fear it might be the enemy? And Louisa said, no. On the contrary, I feel as though plunged into immense and deep sea. Okay. So Louisa needs to know that the devil cannot know the depths that to which God will bring a soul who is in union with him. The devil doesn't have that information. He has to. The higher you go into union with God, the further the enemy. He can only bark from a distance, you know. So Louise is plunged into this immense and deep sea. Now that immense and deep sea is the divine will. And my only fear is that I might go out of the abyss of this sea. But while I fear, I feel its waves rising more powerfully over me, plunging me even deeper. And Jesus said, and this is why the enemy cannot get close. Because the waves of my sea, of my will, while plunging you into the abyss of it, maintain the guard and keep even the shadow of the enemy far away. See, the enemy can't touch the divine will. And so the deeper we are in the divine will, the safer we are. Okay. In fact, the enemy knows nothing of what the soul does and suffers in my will. Isn't that interesting? Nor does he have the means, the ways, or the doors to be able to enter into it. So therefore, we are in a completely different kingdom. We have a completely different king. We have a completely different ruler. Everything is different. The enemy can't get at it. The only thing the enemy can try and do, do you remember he was holding her heel mm-hmm. on that journey, is to try and see if he can pull you out of that into a lower level. If he can get you out of that into a lower level, yeah, he can attack. But if you stay there in the divine will, he can't pull you down. On the contrary, he said, the divine will is the thing which Satan abhors the most. That in itself would make you go in, wouldn't it? Yeah. And if sometimes my wisdom manifests something of what the soul does in my will, the enemy feels such rage as to feel his infernal pains being multiplied, because my will, loved and fulfilled in the soul, forms paradise, while not loved and not fulfilled forms hell. Now there's a statement that really, really needs to be looked at. The divine will is the essence of everything. Everything is in it. And who we are and where we arrive on our journey in life depends on our reaction to the divine will. So we absorb the divine will. We are absorbed into the divine will. We're safe. We've got all happiness. And if we reject it and rebel against it and act against it as Satan does, you've got hell. So now you know how hell was formed. By him just pulling away from the divine will and acting against it, hell was formed. Isn't that interesting? So, therefore, if you want to be safe from any diabolical snare, take to heart my will and live continuously in it. So, here's a little statement for you. Divine will increases heaven in the soul, and divine will increases hell in the damned. And the awful thing is that there are people on this planet living both heaven and hell. It's really awful. So May 9th, 1924, the purpose of chastisement is to prepare the way of the Lord. See, all of this cleansing that the Lord needs to do is all to prepare the way for his coming. Greg talks about the red carpet that we are knitting for him on his return, and he'll walk on this red carpet, but he's got to return to the earth. But the earth has to be cleansed for him to return. And that's the message of Isaiah chapter 40, to pull down the hills of pride and fill in the valleys of unbelief so that the king can actually walk, come on his chariot into the earth. Isaiah 40. So the purpose of the chastisements is to make it actually possible for the Lord to return to the earth. So Louisa said, I spent my days in the most profound bitterness and in deep silence on the part of Jesus, and with the most total privation of his loving presence. These are unspeakable pains that I feel, and I believe it's better to pass over them in silence so as not to embitter my hard martyrdom anymore. Now, the Lord will explain this deeper to her as she goes on, that the pain she's experiencing is a divine pain. It's not just a human pain. Okay. So there's a VIP message coming up in the next paragraph, and that is that the divine will is all about God. It's not about us. Now, before we were lifted up onto the level of the divine will, we were living ordinary spirituality and ordinary holiness. And there it was all about us reaching union with God. Once you get into the divine will, it's all about him. It's not about us. So, after struggling very much this morning, blessed Jesus made himself seen in my interior, Luke 17:21, as he was filling me completely with himself. Now, when we fuse in him, that's what he wants to do, is fill us completely with himself. And I, surprised by this unexpected presence, wanted to lament to Jesus about his privation, but he did not give me the time to do it because it's all about him. All afflicted, he told me, my daughter, how embittered I feel. Creatures have put 3 nails into me, not into my hands, but into my heart and breast, which give me the pains of death. They are preparing 3 conspiracies, one uglier than the other. And in these conspiracies, they are taking aim at my church. Now, I think I could be wrong. It's communism, Illuminati and Freemasonry are the 3 biggies. I could be wrong. Man does not want to surrender in evil. On the contrary, he wants to precipitate his race even more. That means that in going down the route of evil, the human race is actually committing suicide. It's planetary suicide. And while saying this, he showed me secret meetings. You see, these are the occultic meetings of all of these people, in which they were plotting how to assail the church. Now, you know, at the time we're talking, 1924, this desperate persecution of the church in Russia broke out. Some how to cause new wars and some new revolutions. And this was the time for the infiltration of the clergy as well. How many horrifying evils could be seen? And my sweet Jesus resumed speaking. He said, my daughter, it's not right for my justice to arm itself against man, to strike him and almost destroy the many lives that dirty the earth. Now, that's Revelation 11:18. I will destroy the destroyers. OK. And to make entire regions disappear. Do you see that? That's come back again together with them, so that the earth may be purified. And so many pestiferous lives. Look at that description of a human life. It's like a plague. Isn't that amazing? And of so many incarnate devils. In other words, human beings have reached such evil that Jesus would say that the devil is incarnated in them. He said that about one of his apostles, didn't he? Mm-hmm. One of you is a devil, he said. Which, disguised under the thin veil of apparent good, are plotting ruins for the church and for society. Now, one of the things that I think is that the Lord has to speak with the ultimate charity here, in case we just get lost in examples and that kind of stuff. But I think one of the things he's talking about here is that the communists put atheistic men into our seminaries and paid them very well to go through the seminaries and get ordained so that they could destroy the church from within. And because these men were atheists, they had no faith whatsoever, they brought homosexuality into the clergy. And so this terrible disease and infection came into the church. Do you think that my absence from you is something trivial? No, no, on the contrary, the more prolonged my absence is from you, the graver the chastisements will be. And then, remember how many things I have told you about my will. So the evils, the destructions will serve to fulfill what I have told you, that my will come to reign upon the earth. In other words, the house has to be cleaned before the owner comes back. But my will wants to find the earth purified. That's Malachi 3:3, M-A-L for Malachi 3:3, and Titus 2:14. Titus 2:14. My will wants to find the earth purified, and in order to purify it, destructions are needed. Therefore, have patience, my daughter, and never go out of my will, because everything that takes place within you will serve for the work. Everything, the privations, the sleep, your inability to pray, absolutely everything. I think that's wonderful. That my will may have its dominion to come as though in triumph to reign in the midst of men. But when you see the amount of evil that's in the earth even now, for the divine will to triumph will be some extraordinary change, won't it? At this message of Jesus, now my text says speaking, but that's not English. At this message of Jesus, I remained resigned, yes, but highly afflicted. The thoughts of the great evils of the world and of his privation are like a double-edged knife that kills me and to my greater torment doesn't make me die. Okay. So, then on the following morning, my sweet Jesus made himself seen in my interior as though sunken deep inside, and he told me, my daughter, I am posted within you, and from inside of you, I look at what the world is doing. So we have to understand that our soul is a space for the Lord. The theologians will tell you that a church is a locus or a space in which the body of Christ will come to worship the Lord. Now, inside of us, we are a space, hence it has to be emptied of all sin and all selfishness and all worldliness and everything, to let the Lord do his divine work in us and to reign from the throne of our hearts. Isn't it a wonderful thing? That he wants to look out at the world through you and he wants to speak to others through you. You may or may not be conscious of him doing that. Others will. Some of them may or may not say it to you. Do you know what I mean? But it's still working. He said, from inside of you, in other words, Louisa is his earthly throne. I look at what the world is doing. In you, I find the air of my will. Therefore, he can breathe. And I feel I can be there with the decorum or the dignity that befits my person. Because he, with the divine will, he cannot be around something unworthy. Okay, so you can put Habakkuk 1:13 there. Habakkuk 1:13. Lord, you are too holy to look upon evil. Okay. And he has explained elsewhere in these writings that there was no way he could have become incarnate in the body of his mother if she hadn't been completely worthy of God. There's no way at all. Otherwise, she would literally have burnt into cinders at touching the holiness of God. And you see in the book of Exodus that in the very earliest stages of the spiritual journey, that people didn't realize that touching the holiness of God was so serious. And so some people actually burnt, you know, the fire just came out. Because holiness and unholiness doesn't touch. And we had that beautiful moment in Greg's story when the Lord was going to touch him and said, can you get someone holy? Something on you needs to be holy. And poor Greg didn't know what holy was. That's beautiful. But I think it's magnificent that the Lord wouldn't touch him unless there was something holy there. That tells us you should be wearing your medals and everything, you know. It's true that my will is everywhere, but oh, how different it is for it to be the life of the person and for the person to live in it. What a different reality it is. In the other points, my will is in the midst of creatures. It finds itself isolated, offended, unable to carry out the goods it contains and to form a life all from itself and for itself. On the other hand, wherever I find a soul who offers herself to wanting no other life but my will, my will finds company. It is loved. It carries out the goods it contains and it enjoys placing them in common with the soul so as to form a life from itself and for itself. In other words, he sets up home. we become a Bethany for him. We become a Nazareth. In other words, we give him a place to live on the earth. And in finding my own things, that means we're living at the level of the divine will. Finding my own things in the soul, that is sanctity, light, and my very will acting in her. He said, I find myself, so I'm at home. I find myself with honours and with dignity, just as I was in my humanity when I was on the earth, in which my divinity living within that humanity was as though posted and covered with the garment of my humanity. In other words, he's describing himself as a living host, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Okay. In the same way, I cover myself with the garment of the soul, so the soul becomes a living host who does my will. I live hidden within her as in my own center, and from inside of her I look at the evils of creatures and I cry and pray for them. That's why you sometimes get the urge to either cry or pray for them as well, because you're actually touching that. So beside that, I want you to put Galatians 2:20, I no longer live, Christ lives in me. And in seeing that one from their stock, that's one of the human beings, has my life as life also on the earth, how many evils and chastisements do I not hold back out of regard for her? So beside that, I want you to put Hebrews 7:25. Hebrews 7:25 says that the Lord forever lives to make intercession for us. Okay, and so he gets us to make intercession for others. That's him stimulating us from within. How many times I am in the act of destroying them and of ending it all with them because of the great evils they commit. But by just looking at you, I think you need to really colour that one. By just looking at you and looking at my will that's in you and its stronghold within you, I post myself again and I abstain from doing it. Isn't that wonderful? Therefore, my daughter, have patience. And let my will always have complete life in you. Is that okay? Now, a topic I want to bring up at our next meeting comes up in May 13, 1924. True adoration, as distinct from adoration. True adoration consists in the complete accord of the union of the will of God with the soul. Notice the complete accord. That's a little journey that you have to take. The true and perfect model of adoration is the Blessed Trinity. You don't look to anybody on earth and what they're up to. One flight of the soul in the divine will is enough for Jesus to fulfill all her involuntary voids of love. In other words, to make one successful move into that real adoration. He makes up for everything, all your faults and failings. It's not bad, is it? I'd try the adoration, wouldn't you? Okay. So, Louisa said, I was doing my usual prayers, and while abandoning all of myself in the arms of the Supreme Will, in the Supreme Will, I intended to do my adorations to the Divine Majesty. Now, notice the intention is important. Why are you going? What are you doing? What do you want to achieve? And my Jesus, moving in my interior, took my poor soul in his arms and raising it between heaven and earth, adored with me the Supreme Being. Isn't that absolutely incredible? Now, I'm going to give you a very, very, very simple image of that. That is a child in its mother's arms. And the mother says, come on, let's give the dad a big hug. The two of us together. Mm-hmm. You see, the Lord keeps on wanting me to give you very simple images that are perfectly understandable. But that's what Louise is saying, that with Jesus, she was able to join him in his adoration of the Father in the Holy Spirit. Isn't that something? That's what we want to talk about, you see. So, My Jesus, moving in my interior, took my poor soul in his arms and raising it between heaven and earth, adored with me the Supreme Being. It's divine, it's complete, it's heavenly, it's everything. And then he said, my daughter, true and perfect adoration lies in the complete accord of the union of the will of God and the soul. That means you have got to reach this point of union. The more the soul makes her will one with that of her Creator, the more complete and perfect her adoration is. Now notice it's not saying prayers. It's not being noisy, if I can put it that way. Okay. And if the human will is not one with the divine, even more if it's far away from God, it cannot be called adoration at all. It's only a shadow or colourless shade, which leaves not even a trace. And yet we have some terrible tragedies like people reading books in an adoration chapel. Or saying such long strings of prayers that God is waiting for the hour to be up. In other words, you've burnt his ears with words. But there has been no contact between the soul and God. It's just saying all these prayers and feeling good about it. So in the divine will, you've got to go right inside. You're going right inside into the heart of the Trinity. So I'm going to do an exercise with you at our next gathering about this. So can you imagine him feeling that my hour of adoration was only a colourless shade? Janie Mac. And if the human will is not disposed to receive the kiss of the union of the supreme will, instead of adoration, it can be insult and scorn. In other words, if there's something in me that absolutely doesn't want to cooperate with something in him, then sorry. It's not only not adoration, it's the opposite. The first act of adoration is to recognize the will of the Creator. So I presume you're there in order to do it. If this is there, she adores with words, but in fact she insults and offends. Hang on.
Not there.
No. That's right. Yeah. If it's not there, it's only an insult. Now that's like somebody giving you a kiss and you know darn well it's only a perfunctory thing. And it would be an awful lot better if they hadn't done anything, you know, if they made no sign towards you at all. Or the example that I used to give about, you know, you go to a party and someone says, oh, you're very welcome, you know, and behind your back saying, what is she doing here? How did she get here? Who invited her? Okay, so the first act of adoration is to recognize the will of the Creator in order to do it. If this is not there, she adores with words. In fact, she insults and offends. Now, I'm afraid some of that is actually going on because people are not instructed properly about the need to be in union with God. And if you want to know the true and perfect model of adoration, come with me into the midst of the three divine persons. So you need nothingness badly. Okay. So I don't know how, but Jesus clasped me more tightly and raised me higher into the midst of an unending light. That's 1 Timothy 6:16. God lives in unapproachable light. And 1 John 1:5, God is light. So I was raised higher into the midst of an unending light. I felt myself being annihilated, but my annihilation was overtaken by a divine life. So she goes into her absolute nothingness and then the divine life takes over, which unleashed from itself many different shades of beauty, sanctity, light, goodness, peace. In other words, she's plunged into the divine will in such a way that my nothingness was transformed by these divine shades. Now, I want to give you that in one sentence. I plunge myself into my nothingness and I let this nothingness flow into the divine will. The I am not of the creature joins the I am of the Creator. And that's the perfect connection. The I am nothing I am not of the creature flows into the I am of the creator. Because if I'm not in my nothingness, what am I doing trying to go there? I don't even know who I am. So my nothingness was transformed by those divine shades to the point of no longer being recognized and of enamoring the very one who had so much embellished me. Now, it's not possible to go into that divine fire, which is light and love. It's not actually possible to go in there and not come out embellished. Okay. And my sweet Jesus resumed speaking and he said, see, my daughter, the primary act of the divine persons is the perfect accord of our will. Now, if someone had asked the question, what was the primary act of the three divine persons, you mightn't have said that. Well, you have his answer for it. Our will is so unified that the will of one cannot be distinguished from the will of the other. So much so that even though our persons are distinct, we are three, our will is one. And this one will produces a continuous, this is number one now, this one will produces a continuous act of perfect adoration among the divine persons. One adores the other. This accord of will produces equality of sanctity. That's number two. It produces equality of light, of goodness, of beauty, of power, of love. And it establishes in us the true reign of order and of peace, giving us immense joys and happiness. You don't need happiness. S is not English. True joys and happiness and infinite beatitude. Now notice the secret is one will. And you're told that all their joy and happiness and peace and everything comes from the fact that you have one will. Now the difficulty you have on earth is that you can have four people in the same house and you've got four different wills. And never will they meet. They'll often cross swords. But they mightn't actually come together. And so it can be even crucifixion for a person living in the divine will in that kind of a setting. Okay. But in the divine, it's that. And for us to enter into that pure adoration, it means that we have to go right in there. And to go right in there, I've got to leave everything, all my baggage behind me. I've got to leave it all out because it won't fit. It won't be acceptable. I've got to go in there in my nothingness. So the accord of the human will with the divine is the first link of connection and therefore the first link of adoration. Is that okay? Between the creator and the creature. And from this link, the divine virtues descend into the soul as within a channel, producing in her true adoration and perfect love for her creator. And rising from within the same channel of connection, she receives the different shades of the divine qualities. See, you can't go in and not come out embellished. It's just not actually possible. And every time the soul rises in order to dive into this eternal will, she's embellished by and acquires as many more varieties of the divine beauty. Therefore, we will know if we have reached adoration because you will change. Now, one of the things that I have always found very challenging about Saint Therese of Lisieux is that she made a claim nobody else has ever made that I know of. And that is, she said, every single time she received communion, she was aware of growing in holiness. Now, I've never met anybody else, including myself, who could make that claim. So what you're talking about there is that she went into this divine union in communion. Some people receive communion, say nice prayers and go home. She entered into that divine union every time. So I want to give you a heading for the next paragraph. It's a wonderful paragraph. And the heading is Danger, God at Work. Because I think that if our churches were working properly, that sign should be outside of all of them. So this is why I say that the soul who does my will is my amusement and my contentment, his joy and contentment. And in order to enjoy myself, I keep the brush of my will in my hands. That's to keep working with her. That's Ephesians 2:10. In other words, he won't stop working on you for as long as you live. And as she dives into my will, I touch her up. I love that expression. And I enjoy myself by impressing on her with the brushstroke of mine one more shade of my beauty, my love, my sanctity, and all my qualities. So for me, being in her and being in heaven are the same thing. Because in both, he's in the divine will. Okay? I find the same adoration of the divine persons. I find my will and I find my love. Now, someone who gave a great testimony about that is, I don't know whether she's blessed or Saint Elizabeth of the Trinity. She's Carmelite nun. Is she saint?
Saint.
Yeah. She was the first major testimony that the church had received about somebody talking about union with the Trinity as distinct from one of the persons. And since there's always something that can be given to the creature, I act sometimes as a skillful painter. That's your Ephesians 2:10. And I portray my image in her, or as a teacher. I teach her the highest and most sublime doctrines, Romans 8:29. I teach her that, yeah, sometimes as a passionate lover, giving and wanting love, that's the Song of Songs. In sum, I use and perform all my art to amuse, enjoy myself with her. Now, I've also written down John 6:45. Psalm 71:17 and Psalm 119 verse 102. And when my love, offended by creatures, finds no place in which to take refuge, in which to find escape from those who chase me and give me death or force me to set off to the vault of the heavens, in other words, they don't want him at all, I take refuge in the soul who contains my will. Isn't that wonderful? Mm-hmm. So I want to give you, for those who want to get rid of him, Ezekiel 10, verses 18 to 19, and Ezekiel 11, 22 to 23. The first one is the Lord has to leave and then they repent and he comes back. Ezekiel 10, verses 18 to 19. So the Lord says he takes refuge in the soul that contains his will. So with all the problems that's going on in Ireland, you can see that the Lord is taking refuge in us. So the soul that contains my will within herself, and there I find my power that defends me, my love that loves me, my peace that gives me rest. Look what he's looking for. I find everything I want. Therefore, my will connects everything together, heaven and earth and all goods, and it makes them one. And from this alone derive all possible and imaginable goods. Okay. From this alone derive all possible and imaginable goods. I've written down Psalm 85, verses 10 to 11. This psalm talks about love and loyalty now meet. Righteousness and peace embrace. Loyalty reaches up to heaven and righteousness comes down to the earth. So this is the wonderful thing that happens for the soul that keeps the connection with God alive and open. So because the soul, therefore, holds the divine will inside of themselves, heaven and earth are connected in that person. And therefore, you have Jacob's ladder That is John 1:51. The angels of God are going up and down, keeping heaven and earth connected through that soul. And therefore, you have reparation going up to heaven through that soul, and mercy and forgiveness coming back down. This is the business or the economy of the angels, bringing things both ways. So I can say to that soul who does my will, that that soul is everything for me and that I am all for her. Now, do you want me to finish this message? Okay. Then my beloved Jesus withdrew from the depth of my heart and he disappeared from me. I remained comforted, yes, strengthened, but prey to the sorrow of having been left without him and of having told him not even a word about my hard state. You see, the days are gone when she can talk about her problems. When one is with Jesus, the soul flatters herself that she will possess him forever and she feels the need for nothing. All troubles disappear with Jesus. All goods enter the field. And as he withdraws, the troubles come back. And the pain of his privation sharpens its edge even more, which, ripping her poor heart open without pity, renders her pain ever new and more intense. So she's describing the effect of having this intense communion with the Lord all the time. We don't have it, so you don't have the same effects. Okay. In the meantime, my Jesus appeared again and he told me that he had his heart all wounded by 1,000 punctures. And he said to me, my daughter, it's you who made these wounds in my heart. Now, that's all she needs to hear, isn't it? She'll go into a crisis instantly. As you were calling me, you were wounding me. As you would remember that you were without me, you would repeat the wounds. And as you would suffer because of my privation, you would add more to the wounds. Now, this is a new way of him saying, is there any chance at all that you could forget yourself and really, really, really go into the divine will? We find that very difficult. Very difficult. Now, I love Louisa having problems with it because it makes me feel better. I don't know about you. If she didn't have problems about it, I think I would have thrown the books away and said, forget about it, it's not for me. I remember reading a book of a certain holy person. I won't give you the name for fear I prejudice you. And I was halfway through the book and I said, oh, forget about it. It was a woman and they presented her as what I call pluperfect. I mean, she was perfect from the day she was born. Just now a model for us. Someone struggling like this, I think this is fantastic. Because then you can acknowledge the struggle that goes on in yourself and you can acknowledge it's okay. It's actually okay. And through Louisa's struggles then, the Lord gives us the direction we need in our struggles. That's what's so wonderful about it. So on hearing this, Louisa said, my love, if you knew how my heart bleeds because of you, he's blaming her and she's blaming him. I think it's divine, if you excuse me for using that word. If you knew how much my heart bleeds because of you and how wounded and bittered I feel because of your privation to the point that I can take no more. So I feel more wounded than you do. She doesn't let him away with anything. And Jesus said, let's see then who has more wounds. Okay, whether it is you or me. So Jesus visited the interior of my soul and then he made the comparison between himself and me to see who had more wounds. Whether I or Jesus. To my surprise, and I shouldn't have surprised her, I saw that Jesus had more wounds than I did, although I had quite a few. And Jesus continued, have you seen how I am more wounded than you are? However, know that there are various voids of love because of my privation. But do not fear, I will take on the commitment of fulfilling them. Now, the voids of love are the points in which she's reflecting on herself that I'm having a hard time and I don't like this hard time and I'd like it to change. And they're the voids of love. She hasn't filled them in. And he said, don't worry, I'll fill them in for you. Because I know that you cannot do what you do when you're together with me. So, since it's not your will to form these voids of love, your Jesus will take care of fulfilling them. One flight, now this is, we're back to the adoration again. One flight I make you do in my will be enough to put the whole lot of it right. Isn't that fantastic? In such a way that overflowing outside, this love will flow for the good of our brothers. And therefore, he has said this endlessly to her. Let me do, trust me. It's a good place to end tonight. Mm-hmm.